Once more unto the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting second hour of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and...
Jake McClure.
You know, I go through that funny voice thing when I do that just to bring back yesteryear.
What, the funny voice? And who was that masked man?
Right, you got it. The tales of yesteryear. I love that term. That was so cool back then. Anyway, for those of you who don't know, this is Jeff McClure, and I am old enough that I remember listening to The Lone Ranger on the radio. And it wasn't nostalgic golden radio. It was just, okay, we listen to The Lone Ranger on the radio, which means I'm really old. Hey, it was a really interesting article, if I can find it here. Here it is. The New York Stock Exchange, well, there's a couple of, actually two different articles. One was in the Wall Street Journal, and it had what I think is an absolutely fascinating article about how ETFs and index funds have changed the performance of the S&P 500 measurably. And so the Standard & Poor's organization is now changing the way they measure the S&P 500 as far as weighting the, you know, it's a capital weighted, for those of you who don't know, the S&P 500 stock index, like the Dow Jones Industrial Average. Well, it's different from the Dow Jones. So anyway, the S&P 500, like many indices or indexes, is capital weighted, which means that the total value of the stock of a given company in the S&P 500 determines its percentage in the index. In other words, it's not like they take 500 stock prices and average them together. They weigh the average and give more power, if you will, in the average to larger companies. And, of course, one of the problems we run into here is as more and more people invest in the S&P 500 indexes and indices and stuff like that, then more money... If you put $100 or if you put $1,000 into an S&P 500 index mutual fund or a ETF, it doesn't go equally to 500 companies. The majority of it will actually go to about 10 companies in the S&P 500 because that 10 companies, 10 or 20 companies, constitutes the majority of the value in the entire index. And, of course, more money that goes since more money is being given to them than the other companies, they tend to get bigger because they get more money,
right,
which means that as new money comes in, they get even bigger, and it distorts. They finally, we were saying this back in 2000, 1999 and 2000, 1998 even. But, you know, finally S&P and some other folks have said, whoa, you know, that's right. It only took them 14 years to realize we were right.
Pretty simple thing when you look at...
It's a Ponzi scheme.
Right.
And, of course, this causes greater volatility. So here's how they solve the problem. And I love it. They're not going to count. They're only going to count float now.
Float.
Float.
Which
means the actual stock that's traded on the exchanges. It turns out, for instance, back when Microsoft was knocking the ball out of the park and making huge gains.
Uh-huh.
Only a minority of the stock was traded. The majority of it was owned by some guy named Bill Gates.
Oh, well, not the majority,
and
but a
Ballmer,
large
basically
portion.
The insiders who had restricted stock who weren't trading it owned the majority of it. But when they weighted Microsoft in the S&P 500, they gave they took the stock, wasn't traded on the exchange. What happened is it actually got a multiplier of about 2.
Yeah.
In its weighted average, which is one of the reasons they concluded that in the 1990s, the S&P 500 went up so fast.
You've just talked so much geek that most people out there probably didn't follow a big bunch of what we just said. Basically, the way the S&P 500 acts is it takes all the companies out there and finds the one that's the heaviest. So Walmart, it takes all of its stocks outstanding times the price of the stock.
The heaviest stock.
Yeah, so the heaviest stock. It's an overweight person or in a group, and they say, all right, when they make a when they step, it has more effect in the elevator than when a 2-year-old child does.
Right.
Well, some companies tend to have more impact on the market than others. Well, the thing is, some of that weight isn't being used. That's what you're saying. So when this person comes in and steps in the elevator, the S&P 500, the way it was calculated, was saying, okay, here's what we're going to do. We're going to calculate how much weight comes into the elevator. And the problem is that a big chunk of that weight didn't come into the elevator. He left it at home.
At the end of the 1990s, when Microsoft was the biggest company as far as dollar value in the S&P 500, only about half of that value was actually in the stock market, which is really weird. Let's just say that we'll use $1,000, like the total value, just so we can understand the numbers. If Microsoft, the total value of all the shares outstanding, was worth $1,000, and the S&P 500, only had $10,000 in it, well, obviously one-tenth of the entire weight of the S&P 500 would be given to Microsoft.
Right.
And of course, then, whenever Microsoft moved,
the whole elevator would shake.
The entire S&P 500 would move one-tenth as much as Microsoft did. So the more Microsoft had this huge effect on the S&P 500. Well, here's the funny thing. Of that $1,000 that was being used as the weighting,
Only about
$500 was actually in the market. The rest of it was just not doing anything. It was sitting there. So they were giving, in effect, multiplying the value of the big tech companies that had, in many cases, the absolute majority of their shares were held outside of the market.
Yep. Well, you brought...
And of course, you couldn't sell them. People weren't going to sell them. Therefore, the price was not likely to go down because they held them.
You have very nicely led to the thing that I've been planning on talking about all week, actually. The Shiller PE. Are you familiar with this?
Yeah, but I don't like it.
Either do I. I'm going to talk about it because it is it's hitting a lot of the headlines.
Which is physical education, and it is
no.
No. The teacher's name is Shiller.
No.
No?
That's not it.
No.
Nope.
Well, P.E. is when I used to go out to P.E.
Right.
When I
put
was
your
kid.
Shorts on. Go
okay.
out to P.E. No. the Shiller P.E. is the price-to-earnings ratio that Shiller used to actually predict a couple of the times in the market when it was really overpriced and it needed to drop.
Of course, now he predicted about 10 other times when
yes.
it didn't drop. But
predicted
that's
a lot
point.
Of
yeah.
times. If anybody out there has actually listened to more than one program, which is questionable.
I can only listen to one at a time.
Right. You hear us talking about price-to-earnings ratio of the S&P 500. We talk about it a lot. And every day it seems like there's a new way of calculating that. So there is no standard way of calculating price-to-earnings ratio on the market. There is no standard way of calculating price-to-earnings ratio on a stock. It seems like a really simple ratio. You just look at the price, and you look at the earnings, and you say, how long would it take for the earnings to pay for the stock? Makes sense, except that which earnings do you use? Do you use the last year's earnings? Do you use the expected earnings for the next year? Do you use the earnings for the year that is expected after that? Do you use the last 10 years' earnings? And what Shiller did is he said, I'm going to take the last 10 years, so as if we weren't complicated enough with just not even knowing which earnings to use. He said, oh, I know what I'll do. This is a very simple solution. I'll take the last 10 years of earnings for the whole stock market.
And average them.
Not just average. Well, right. You've got to wait a second. Take the last 10 years, then look at the consumer price index and adjust it all for inflation, and then average it.
And then it's a time-weighted average, too.
Yes, and it's a time-weighted average.
The bottom line to it is, when he gets done with his price-to-earnings ratio...
It doesn't look like anything else.
But nobody but him can understand what the heck it is.
Right. But what it has done in the past is it's been able to say, in years when there's a lot of poor earnings and then a jump in earnings that's out of the average... He can say those aren't real earnings, and his big success was in 2000.
Right.
Because he said, there's something wrong here. These earnings aren't matching up with the averages over the past. We got a big jump, and what we were really seeing was Arthur Andersen cooking books everywhere. So, yes,
Arthur Andersen should go on the Food Channel.
Yes, he should.
Here's how you cook a book.
This is a cookbook for books.
Right. Hey, that's cool. I never thought about
add,
that.
Add the third accounting manual to the pot. so he was able to predict the crash in 2000 by saying the averages don't match up with this big jump in earnings. We're not seeing real earnings here. There's something wrong. Since then, he's predicted quite a few crashes that didn't happen and hasn't been really right on any of them. The timing was off. He was very correct in 2000, but that ratio is coming up again. People are saying the Shiller price-to-earnings ratio is high right now. Mm-hmm. Historically, it's at 14. Right now, it's at 26. The problem with that is that we're coming out of a recession. When you're in a recession, your earnings aren't so good. If you use those earnings from the past 5 years and say this is the normal earnings rather than the earnings of a recession, and you say this means this is what will happen forever into the future, you got the problem. There's a problem not with the math, but with the reason why you're using the math. Anyway, that's what I wanted to say. There's a lot of people talking about that. When people hear us talking about price-to-earnings ratio, what we've done is, because the accounting practices changed after Arthur Andersen was cooking books, I don't even know that they were using good seasoning in their cooking, because it wasn't coming out tasting very good. Some people thought it tasted like sugar.
Oh, no, I think some people really liked the way it
but
tasted.
But the
for a
end
while.
Result is it caused a lot of indigestion.
A lot of heartburn. Yeah.
Yes. So after that, the Congress, in one of its strangely ethical and effective manners, it doesn't happen very often, they passed some laws changing the way accounting takes place. And now it is a crime that you can go to jail for
bookcooking.
Bookcooking, basically.
Well, only in public companies.
Right, only in public companies. So this law was passed, and now we can say when a company comes out and says, this is our expected earnings into the future, the law says that if they intentionally inflate that, the CEO can go to prison. That's not, you get a fine. That's not, hey, you don't get a bonus this year. It's, hey, come in here. This guy over here with the tattoos, his name's Bubba.
That's part of...
He's going to be sharing your bunk.
Isn't that part of Monopoly?
Yes, I think so. Go to jail, go direct your mail, do not pass go.
You're right.
Yes. So that is a truism today. So when we look at the accounting of the companies and they say these are projecting earnings, they're going to lower it so that they don't go to jail. They're not going to inflate it. They're going to err on the downside, not the upside. They used to err on the upside because that sold more stocks. Now people are going to jail for it. So they say, oh, we're going to err on the downside, mm-hmm. which means that when we look at the expected earnings, the projected earnings by a company for the next 12 months and for the next 24 months, we get a really good idea of what they expect to happen, a true idea of what they expect to happen. And that's what we use for
a
our
conservative
price
conservative idea, yeah.
And by that estimation, we have a very, very low price-to-earnings ratio,
yeah.
which says that the stock value is way undervalued.
And AllianceBernstein came out and agreed with us.
Well, that means that they are brilliant.
Which, you know, absolutely. We have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, it seems like every time there's a meltdown in the market or in housing or something, the Congress passes a whole new series of laws. I think the last round was Dodd-Frank and Consumer Protection Commission or Department
right,
or something.
Right, that's part of Dodd-Frank.
How do you rate, maybe it's too early to tell, but how do you rate the reactionary regulations that were passed, and how do you see that shaking out? I'm going to hang up on this.
Okay.
Thanks for calling.
Well, we tend to overreact. We tend, in most cases, Congress tends to overreact, particularly if they act very quickly after an event. And you looked pregnant with thought there, so I will hand it back up to you in just a minute. But the longer it takes them to act, the more appropriate and bipartisan it is, because it doesn't tend to have so much emotion behind it. Dodd-Frank has a lot of problems in it. It also has a lot of good things in it. The thing is, it's so huge, it's hard to tell the things apart. Part of the privacy regulations that we are being informed about, who has access to our information, all that good stuff, comes from Dodd-Frank. So there's some really good stuff in protecting an individual from misuse by a corporation in Dodd-Frank. But there's also a lot of pretty crazy accounting stuff that goes on.
Generally speaking, over time, we sort those out. There were a whole series of things that Dodd-Frank mandated that the Securities and Exchange Commission do, and then, of course, Congress didn't fund them. And they're still, for instance, asking for comments right now on a uniform fiduciary standard, which Dodd-Frank recommended but didn't require.
Right. What that means is that a standard by which people will act dealing with securities.
Basically requiring stockbrokers to be fiduciaries, which I personally don't think will work. Stockbrokers,
they're not fiduciaries.
Quote, financial advisors are salespeople. Most of them can't spell fiduciary. There is a place in the world for unbalanced salespeople. Boy, that's interesting. People are unbalanced? Yeah, okay.
Give them
anyway,
some V8.
Right. And there's a place in the world for investment advisors. They're under different laws right now. Dodd-Frank wanted to place all of the security salespeople, and it kind of watered down a little bit, under a fiduciary standard where they had to always act in your best interest, which means...
Or go to jail.
Which means most of the broker-dealers like Merrill Lynch and so on would promptly go out of business because they're not in business to help you. They're in the business to making money.
Well, they're in the business of making money by helping you.
Well, they're
but
in... Well,
fiduciaries
I
are in
with
the,
that.
The fiduciaries are in the business... Well, suitability means that it's got to be in your good interest.
Well, it might...
So they're helping you.
Well, sometimes it's in your... For example, when they were selling the mortgage securities.
Yeah.
A lot of times they knew they were garbage. They can show that they knew they were garbage. But they were selling them anyway because they said people wanted them and it's an open market and it wasn't completely unsuitable because we gave them a prospectus that was 400 pages long and it told them in there that this is garbage.
Well, the thing is there's a lot of lawsuits against Merrill Lynch over that and they are losing the lawsuits in the places where they were presenting things that weren't suitable. That's important to know.
And
stockbrokers tend to be ethical people. There are rare exceptions that tend to hit the headlines.
Well,
fiduciary standard, though, would take the good, ethically minded people that are out to make a living and cause them to go out of business.
It might.
The fiduciary standard on what we do, we have to have very high net worth people in order to do the type of research and the type of time it takes to do what we call due diligence on an investment to make sure it is in their best interest. We can't afford to do that with a smaller portfolio.
It really boils down to exactly what's going on in the medical world, where if a person comes in with a relatively minor issue, they still have to have a battery of tests.
Yeah, 18 gajillion tests done.
A tremendous amount of money spent on them to make sure that it's not something more serious or... They will get sued.
Because there's a fiduciary standard there.
And if you do that to stockbrokers, there will be a lot fewer stockbrokers.
And it'll be a lot more expensive.
And it will be a lot more expensive. The threat of a fiduciary standard, by the way, is shutting down online discount brokers right and left right now.
Because how can you be a fiduciary if you're just allowing people to trade on your charging trading?
Those were exceptions to the fiduciary standard. But... An example, what I was referring to is even the suitability rule was not applied when they were selling bonds to school districts, for example, because they were considered to be sophisticated institutional investors.
Except that they're not so sophisticated.
And under Dodd-Frank, the companies that were selling those to Orange County and school districts and things like that, Merrill Lynch is the poster child for this, which is why they went out of business and got bought by Bank of America. But they sold things that they knew they were going to blow up. Anyway, there is a degree of value in a caveat emptor, buyer beware securities market.
Right.
The key is, at least in my opinion there, which is something that Dodd-Frank did not address, is when a stockbroker, a salesperson, calls him or herself a financial advisor, people assume... That's supposed to happen. That's my kind of a soapbox. I want to change the subject, though.
Yes, let's change the subject.
ETFs. We don't use them, except on rare occasions where we're really, really, really comfortable that they are the proper thing to use. They are inherently dangerous.
ETFs. Let's define that.
It's exchange-traded fund.
There you go.
It is, people think of it as a form of mutual fund. In some cases it is, but in other cases it isn't. Let me give you an example. The reason people like to use exchange-traded funds is because they trade all day on the New York Stock Exchange. You can buy and sell them. Jeff doesn't think that's a good idea, but the reason they are...
Neither does Jake.
...so well advertised is because, quote, they're very low cost. They have lower costs, typically, than regular mutual funds. Okay.
Right. Okay.
And most of them are index-related, which is a fascinating thing.
We just talked about that a minute ago.
There's two issues that are that come up. They're actually in Barron's today in the focus on funds. If your ETF that you purchase is not heavily traded, in other words, if you don't have a consistent high volume in that ETF, not you personally, but the market doesn't have a consistent high volume in that ETF, the spread, and this is what's in the article, meaning the difference between buy and sell. In other words, you bought it today and you sold it immediately and the market had not moved and it has a low volume, which means you're probably the only person buying and selling.
Mm-hmm.
The spread can be 12%.
Ouch.
And even if you have a high volume.
But that means that you bought it today, you immediately sell it and you lose 12%.
Right.
Yeah.
And you don't know, of the thousands of ETFs out there, I hate to break this to you, the majority...
They're low trade. Low volume.
There are 609 exchange-traded funds, notes, and I like the article in the Barron's, and related stuff. See, that's a...
stuff. That's stuff. Technical words.
That had fewer than 10,000 shares trade per day. Like, 10,000 shares, well, that's huge. No, that's the 12%. That's 40% of the entire... If you take all the ETFs, about 40% of them trade so slowly that there's probably about a 12% spread between buy and sell. Now, this is what's even more interesting to me, at least. When you buy or sell an ETF on the market...
Well, they're low costs. They're like a quarter of a percent for the ETF versus half a percent for the fund. And literally, I saw that the other day. The expenses in the ETF were a quarter percent. The same fund, it was a Vanguard ETF, had a half a percent charge in the fund. Okay, cool. The spread on the heavily traded ones is 0.8%. Do you get that?
Mm-hmm.
In other words, when you buy or sell, there is a hidden cost. It's not a commission. It's a spread between buy and sell of 0.8%. In other words, it costs you 0.8% to buy or sell one of these ETFs.
And people do this. They tend to buy.
For low cost.
Right. They people tend to do these ETFs for two reasons. One, they're low cost. And two, you can buy and sell them really quickly. The problem with that is if you buy and sell them really quickly, you compound that cost over and over and over again, which means that your annual cost, if you just do six or seven trades in a year, which a lot of the day traders that are doing this are doing six or seven a day, you have multiplied that
right.
internal cost out into a massive amount of your money. It's that old saying,
right.
You know how to make a small fortune in the stock market.
Start with a large one.
You start with a large one. Yeah.
I like what...
Here's a million-dollar idea. Buy $1 billion worth of Facebook. Yeah.
Exactly. can't think of any Jim, somebody who screams and yells on the... on
Cramer.
No, not Cramer. There's another guy who screams and yells who was quoted to me the other day. Anyway, and
one of the screaming and yelling
MSNBC.
People talk.
He's on MSNBC. And on MSNBC, I like what one of the commentators in the news, in an article in the Wall Street Journal said this week. He said, you know, I could probably have $1 million portfolio if I just followed the advice of MSNBC over the last 10 years. Of course, I would have had to start with $100 million. Literally, he said $100 million.
Yeah. Well, one of the practices that we haven't done in a long time, just because it was ludicrous. We would take the cover of Money Magazine, and it would typically be 10 stocks that never lose money, 3 mutual funds that will always do well for you, and we tracked them. And there's no big surprise.
Massive losses.
Yeah. If you just built a portfolio on what was on the cover of Money Magazine during the 90s, this is when we did this, and we kept all the magazines and we had copies of the covers and we built this thing in Excel where we were tracking and you would lose massive amounts of money, and it's over a long period of time.
And then let me add one more thing about ETFs. The tracking error on ETFs is commonly very high. For example, there was an article in the Wall Street Journal recently about GLD, which is an ETF traded on the New York Stock Exchange. And it's supposed to track gold, and all it holds is gold bullion.
Except that
it was sometimes off 20% and 30% from the cost of gold. So it's just kind of a warning I wanted to throw out. There's a lot of danger in doing whatever the most sexy, exciting thing is.
If you can talk about it and be popular at a cocktail party, you probably shouldn't be investing in it.
And there's two of them are anything that's quote alternative investment. And the other one is ETFs. There's a lot of
hedge funds
too.
As well. They fall right in there.
Yeah, the hedge funds have been falling out of bed really badly this last year.
They were in bed to begin with, which tells you how they're being managed.
Yeah, well, even the ones that weren't doing the at least haven't been charged with insider trading, have generally done far
not
less
so well
than the
yeah.
market.
Yeah.
And somebody asked me yesterday about gold. That's the thing I was
remembering. Yes, there's a long, long way to get to
answer,
gold.
He said, man, gold's been going up so much. And I said, since 2009, roughly 5 years? Anyway.
Four
years. I just got through looking at it, and the stock market has gone up a whole bunch more than gold as percentages. And he says, no, that can't be. The stock market's down. And I said, well, it's relatively low. But if you look at your gains of the last 4 years in gold versus the stock market, you would have done better in the S&P 500. And I certainly am not recommending you invest in the S&P 500. But I'm just simply saying doesn't make any sense. Why
again,
this mania about gold?
You can research this yourself in a very pleasurable way. Discovery Channel had a show called Gold Rush. It's still out there. It started in 2009 where a group of amateurs went up to Alaska and started a gold mine. They failed, and then they got better, and then they failed, and then they got really, really big, and so on and so forth. But they talk about the price of gold at being about $1,600 an ounce. Well, guess what the price of gold is?
What is it?
About $1,600 an ounce. Oh, okay. This has been 4 years. It's still the same. It's still very, very, very profitable. If this is one of the signs of a bubble, by the way. If an amateur can go out and do it, a complex job with absolutely no experience and make money at it in the first 2 years, it's a bubble. If you just think back to when people that didn't know anything about construction were going out and buying houses and painting them yellow and then painting the kitchen yellow and turning around and selling for a profit, that was a bubble. People don't tend to pay more because the kitchen is yellow. That's just not the way it goes. And when an amateur can come into the gold market and within 2 years be making a sizable profit, without any mining training, without 2 years of mining training, if you call the failures in the first 2 years, but the profit over a 2 year period is in any small business very abnormal. And when it has to do with the price of a commodity, it means that the commodity is too high.
There's probably entirely too much truth in what you just said. Let me give you a bigger example. When people ask me about gold, in 1983, when I got a securities license in 1983, January of 1983,
30 years ago,
gold was around $800 an ounce.
Uh-huh.
So today you say it's 16. What is it actually today? I don't know. I haven't tracked it. I thought it was lower than 16. I thought it was in the 1500s.
It's upper 1500s.
So let's just say it's 1600. Okay, guess what? And it pays no dividends.
Right.
So what we're saying is in 30 years, gold has doubled in value. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Well, Rule of 72 says that if I divide the number of years it takes something to double in value into 72, I get the rate of return.
Right.
So if I divide 30 into 72.
Current bid on gold bullion is 1602.90.
Oh, that's right at 1600. Okay. Yeah. So that's the bid. Yeah, okay.
The
so,
ask is 1627.
Okay, so if you bought your $800 ounce of gold in 1983 and you sold it today, it would have doubled in value except for one minor detail. Inflation has run over 3%.
I see what you did there. Wait a minute. What? You said minor detail and you're the gold. I see what you didn't do it on purpose. But
no,
I
but it was a pretty good pun. Yeah. This is an interesting thing. Inflation has run from 1982-1983 time frame to the present above 3%.
Yes, it has.
Gold has only gotten 2-point-something% appreciation over that period.
You lost money.
What's even more is if you had gold, you had to store it somewhere.
However.
But this is interesting. When you sell it, you still got to pay taxes on it.
Yes, correct. You've got to pay taxes on that whole gain.
And it's not even long-term capital gains. It's regular income.
One of the interesting factors here is that from what we were just saying, it sounds like that people don't make money in gold and so on. No, that's not what we're saying. What we're saying is long term, it's not a good investment. Gold over a short period of time has made a lot of money for a lot of people, and it's very easy to look at that and say this is going to go on forever. But as I have said in the past, I had a trivia book that was written in the 1970s when I was growing up, and it said at current rates, everyone in the world will be an Elvis impersonator by the year 1983. And that's what happens when you take a trend line that's going on right now and just say it's going to keep on doing that into the future. The price of any commodity, when it becomes disassociated with the cost of mining it or creating it, just because there's a demand for it, then a lot of people get involved in creating it. If it doesn't cost a lot of money to create something, to create, in this case, gold, you're mining the gold. If it doesn't cost a huge amount of money compared to what you make on it, then the price will come down in the near future because a lot of people will be going and creating this commodity. This is not rocket surgery, people. If someone were offering you a massive amount of money to do something, and they are offering a massive amount of money to everybody to do something, this is the same kind of thing that happens in a Ponzi scheme. After a while, enough people do it that the price of that commodity comes down. This is supply and demand. It's not rocket surgery. When enough people get involved in mining gold, and there's creation of amazing new technologies to pull gold out of seawater, to pull gold out of mine tailings from centuries past, the price is too high and it will have to come down. And we have a new demand coming from Asia in both the subcontinent as well as the continent itself, in India, Pakistan, China, and as well as other areas of developing Asia. There's a new demand for gold. But the demand for gold is not increasing faster than the supply. People are able to go out and make money mining the gold as amateurs, which means that the supply is increasing very fast. This isn't about the myth of gold, that it always does anything. This is about economics, and we have commercials to play.
Speaking of economics, economics, whatever that is, does that make us eco-friendly?
Maybe we are eco-friendly.
Okay,
we're
eco-warriors.
Warriors for the economy.
But you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And we are going to break for commercials. We'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure.
Only have about 13 minutes left in the hour and week.
And we have a caller on 773-1400. The other number you can call is 866-597-1400. So caller on 773-1400. Well, that's a lot of numbers. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Well, I'll apologize in advance for this phone call, but I just had to ask, do the weight loss folks advertise on your show because you manage money for fat cats?
I have absolutely, we have no control over the advertisements that come on here. Occasionally,
however,
I object to them strongly enough, they pull them for the following week.
However, I have been thinking about getting Friskies to come on the air with us and, you know, advertise with the cat food.
Well, I thought the weight loss had to do with the, actually had to do with, it's kind of like when, you know, when you send emails out, Google has an algorithm that looks at the words you use in the email and then posts advertisements next to your Google email.
Right.
And I thought maybe somebody heard us talking about the the weight loss of Microsoft in the market.
There you go.
How they were changing the weighting, and maybe that's why they ran it. Does that make sense?
I have a piece of information. You talk about fat cats, so I'll come in here with this. I have a friend in Austin.
He has a friend.
I don't talk about the fact that I do have a friend, but I do have a friend in Austin that shoots.
In Austin?
Yes, he shoots commercials for Friskies.
What caliber rifle does he use?
It's all camera. I'm sorry.
Like 35 millimeter.
It's larger than that even. But
wow.
He is shooting. And
really big guns.
This little piece of news is kind of cool because I am an internet nerd, and his South by Southwest, he shot a new commercial for Friskies that involves the Grumpy Cat tartar sauce, or Tard for short. I'm sure you've seen the Grumpy Cat. Yes,
I haven't.
I bet you have, and you just didn't realize that there was a name for Grumpy Cat. But he's all over the internet.
Good.
And I just thought it was cool that I know somebody that knows Grumpy Cat.
And that's a fat cat.
Yeah. Well, not really fat, but sort of fat.
So what do you think? So, caller, do you think that works for you?
Sure.
All right. It's always nice to have solutions. Okay, take care. Bye-bye. We're having entirely too much fun here. Hey, I mentioned that AllianceBernstein, they said we're comparing the fact that the S&P 500 is finally up to the level where it was in 2000, but they actually came out with a report that showed how much more healthy the economy and the companies were than in 2000, when we thought everything, nope, I don't recognize that cat. I'm sorry.
Okay.
I am a social nitwit, nerd, something
like
that. Yeah,
I'm a nerd too, and that's why I knew about the cat.
And there's a series of little interesting things that obviously don't make the news because they're not bad news. The Philadelphia Fed Index shows that manufacturing in the Mid-Atlantic is increased, I know that sounds like, to 2.0. It has had negative short-term numbers in the recent past, and a lot of people were very, very concerned. The entire U.S., now they got a different index for the U.S., is at 54.9. Last week was at 54.3. Now, what does that mean? That means that manufacturing, anything above 50 on that particular index, indicates manufacturing is growing, and a 5-point growth, 54.9, roughly 55, is a very significant growth in manufacturing.
If you think of it this way, as a percentage of the index, that's a 10% growth. That's an increase in manufacturing. People, listeners, have called in on many occasions and said that we're losing all our manufacturing and so on. That is not the case.
We've lost a lot of manufacturing jobs.
Yes. When you can 3D print an item rather than having eight people involved in the manufacturing of it, it's a one-person job now. Yes, we lost seven jobs there, but our manufacturing output went up.
And we, right now, the United States has a record manufacturing output. The other thing that's very important to us geeky economics types is the fact that the percentage utilization in the United States is in
Why are we using geeky words?
Well,
where the percentage utilization was at?
Really, when we get up around 90% percentage utilization,
what that means is the
then
capacity.
We're liable to see potential for inflation. We're running at about 77.8 that was just reported.
And what that means, the percentage utilization is the ability for factories
to
make more stuff. If they're at the top, they're not able to make any more than they are at that factory.
Then they start raising prices.
Right, they start raising prices on, and that's inflation starts coming out. So we're at 77%, which means we have a lot of room for growth without inflation.
And the expectations index, according to the Philadelphia Fed, over the next 6 months.
Wait a minute, I have low expectations.
Well, they have high. The manufacturers
I just sit down when I have my expectations. That's why they're lower. I still think things are going to go well.
But
I just sit down.
The expectations index for business conditions over the next 6 months is higher, and it continues to run up. Also, we don't see employment expectations going up. In other words, the manufacturer is saying, we're not planning on hiring a lot more people. We are planning to make more stuff.
Ooh.
That's a pretty
that's productivity
consistent picture across the board.
Now again, that's a new machine coming in to do the job of more more people without having to hire more people.
We're going to come our next show
program
next program
episode
will be at the end of the quarter. But and it's pretty well we can see barring some great disaster what's going to go on. So I'm going to maybe get a little head start on this. We said. At least I said, and I think
we definitely said
that when a Democratic Party president is elected, the stock market and the economy tend to do better by far than when a Republican is elected. Now,
that's not a statement of our political beliefs. It's just a look at history.
I will let you know I did not vote for President Obama.
Nor
did I. Vote, and I didn't vote for him. It puts a very small...
There's not a lot of other people you could have voted for. Yeah,
I voted Republican. But I can also tell you that I know history and I know economics, and I can say that what happened was perfectly normal. And I know that sounds really strange to a lot of people. It's very counterintuitive. But for investors, the reelection of a Democratic president, or a member of the Democratic Party, a Democrat president, I guess is what, means that the economy will tend to do quite well, and the market will do well.
And again, it's just like the cover of The Economist, despite D.C., not because of it, but when... If you think about this, and most of our listeners are right-wing conservative types, if you think about why it is that liberals are elected, these are in comic book or in cartoons.
Because we feel wealthy and well-off,
well,
right?
Well, people elect Democrats because they want to feel good, not necessarily for great fiscal decisions or any of the other things, because it's a feel-good thing. When people feel good, they tend to do better in other aspects of their lives. So long-term decisions, my opinion, is part of the reason why I tend in more cases than not to vote Republican. I would think long-term decisions tend to be made better by the right, by the more conservative people. But the way you feel right now is much more influenced by people that are saying, I'm going to do this because it's going to make us feel better. So, all of that saying that the economy is actually doing better not because of decisions made, but in spite of decisions made in D.C., because we do feel better. Not because they've done anything to make us feel better, because they really haven't, except the fact that they're there.
Well, the only thing I wanted to mention this for was not plus or minus whoever gets elected. It is a simple issue that we look at history, we look at what happens... what things correlate in history with what actually happens in the market. When somebody comes to you and tells you the opposite is going to happen this time, they say it's different this time, then inevitably they're wrong. There's two things you need to watch out for. One of them, it's different this time, and the other one is this could go on forever.
It's different this time. Sometimes it is different. If you're on the railroad tracks and there's somebody in a hand-propelled vehicle that's, you know, like the old Warner Brothers cartoons and the repair vehicle where they're pumping up and down on the thing and it's headed towards you, you should probably get out of the way, but it's not going to kill you. If there's a train coming, you should probably get out of the way. So recognizing
the
event...
Being on the railroad track...
Not a good idea.
...is the thing that's not different.
Yeah, that's not different. Either way, you're going to be damaged.
I suspect that if there's a railroad repair car coming and you insist in standing in the way of it...
Yeah, and you say, well, this isn't a train. It's different this time. Right.
there's another little factoid. By the way, you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach. Another little factoid here that I really thought was appropriate, and it is an indicator of what's going on in the world. SunTech Power Holdings declared bankruptcy this week. SunTech Power Holdings... was, and I quote from the Wall Street Journal, once the poster child for the expansion of Chinese solar industry.
Yep.
As a matter of fact, in 2011, it was one of the biggest players in the world. It was whatever, I don't remember the name of that company that the Obama administration was pushing money into or something, I don't remember. Anyway, the one that went bankrupt because it basically, the Chinese undercut their costs.
The Chinese one is going bankrupt now,
the
too.
The SunTech was the one who undercut them.
The reason why both of them existed to begin with, you know, the Obama administration subsidized and the Chinese subsidized, they think this is a great, exciting thing, but right now it's just too expensive to make energy using that technology.
Well, it's the same thing that the reason that the old TXU is about to, is it going towards bankruptcy rather quickly.
Gas.
People did not anticipate that the cost of energy was going to fall.
Natural gas fracking has changed the picture completely. We have a source of energy that is going to be able to power the country for centuries at a very low price because we found a new way of getting to it. This is very much like what I was describing with gold a few minutes ago. When energy prices remain at a high level for a long period of time, people will develop new technologies to make it come back down. And it's rarely the technology that the government thinks is going to be. In the case of, you know, high energy costs, the government says, well, we must move to solar and wind. And I do think that there is some future potential there. But somebody else said, well, there's a technology that I might be able to implement over here and make natural gas easier to get to, and I'll make a lot of money doing that. So they did. And when subsidies to renewable energies drop, so do the renewable energy companies because they're not profitable in competition.
And it's, but I think it's an interesting thing that the Chinese have allowed this company to go bankrupt.
Yes.
Which indicates that there really are, and this has something to do with the new premier over there, they really are interested in
free markets.
In free markets and capitalism and making things work in that way. You are listening to the personal wealth coach, by the way.
Yes, the fur what?
Yeah. And we are an investment advisory firm who we manage wealth for families, trusts, foundations, and things like that. And I think we do a pretty good job.
I think so too. But we're kind of prejudiced in this area. Time.
And we are making some interesting things happen in the right direction. And if you'd like to contact us off the air, of course, during the week, there'll be somebody there to answer the phone. Right now, there's voicemail at 947-1111, or
you can reach us toll-free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can email us at Jeff or Jake at tpwc.com, and we actually do read those. Or you can go to our website, thepersonalwealthcoach.com, and listen to podcasts. We actually don't listen to those, but you're welcome to. I don't listen to it when we say it live.
And
until next week, this has been the Personal Wealth Coach.
Yeah, it's easy for you to say.
Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood, the best talk in America. News Radio 1400 KTEN.